proceed to the last case of the morning, Alonzo Suggs v. United States. You have to state your name, because I don't know.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom McGrath. I'm here to represent the appellant Alonzo Suggs on the appeal of his 2255 motion. The district court stated in this case, in its opinion denying the 2255 motion, that appellate counsel may have had a legitimate strategy in ignoring the confrontation clause and sentencing issues. The court stated that upon review of this court's reasoning and rulings on the Bruton issue, appellate counsel may have concluded that a Bruton argument did not have a reasonable chance of success on appeal. Now, this conclusion has two problems. First, it's contradicted by the record. The July 18th letter from appellate counsel to Alonzo Suggs laid out appellate counsel's strategy. In the letter, the appellate counsel said, "I did a significant investigation into this case and went over the record more than once and determined that there were some issues that have no merit. But there are other issues that have great merit. Those issues included the confrontation clause and the sentencing issues." At the end of the letter, appellate counsel states, "These are the issues that will be raised on your behalf before the appellate court." And then inexplicably, with no reason in the record, only a multiple conspiracies issue was brought before the court.
The district court foreclosed the opportunity for an evidentiary hearing at which the appellate counsel could have been brought in to explain why he dropped those two issues from the appeal? Is my understanding of the record correct?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. I believe they said there was no evidentiary hearing necessary.
So we really have no explanation in the record as to why those two appellate issues were left out of the direct appeal?
There is none in the record, Your Honor. Secondly, the fact that they were denied does not follow the procedure laid out in Gray v. Greer and Mason v. Hanks. These cases state that a trial court is supposed to examine the trial record for significant and obvious issues. The district court must do this on a 2255. Compare those ignored issues to the issues that were raised in the appeal and determine which is stronger. If the ignored issues are stronger than the ones brought on the appeal, then the presumption of effectiveness is overcome. Now, the court doesn't give any indication that they followed this procedure in the 2255. And if they had, it's clear error to find that these issues were not stronger than the issue that was brought on appeal. I want to start with the Confrontation Clause issue. I'd like to concentrate on the written statement made by Ms. Ogle to the police. That statement was the strongest issue, and it's also inexplicably ignored by the government in their reply on this. Now, the court admitted into evidence a written statement made to police by a co-defendant who did not testify, which implicated Mr. Suggs in a conspiracy to distribute drugs. The potential for a Sixth Amendment violation here is clear. Now, under
I'm not quarreling with what you just said, but I thought that the district judge was admitting that statement not for the truth of what it was, but just to show what the police did in response to that or something.
That's exactly why it was admitted, Your Honor, and there is no support for being able to allow that in under that statement. Mason v. Hanks tells us that you can allow in the fact that a statement was made, but the content is still hearsay. They tried to bypass it by saying that this wasn't hearsay.
Well, that it wasn't offered for the truth.
That it wasn't offered for the truth, that it wasn't hearsay, a statement. And that's why they say Bruton cannot be is not put into effect here. But the fact is that the court went on, or the government went on, to use it for the content to prove the fact that there was a conspiracy.
Were there any cautionary instructions given to the trial jury about the use the limited use of that statement?
There was none, Your Honor. There was a statement saying that statements can only be used against Defendant Ogle that were made by her, but Bruton has shown that that's not enough. So the statement was used to shoot.
Were there any requests by the trial counsel to have the judge instruct the jury on the limited use of that statement?
Not that I'm aware, Your Honor. But the fact is that even if there was, the content was used by the government in closing to show the existence of a conspiracy. They used the content stating in the closing, remember what she told the police. She was contacted by Lowe to do this. She wanted to protect all of the drugs that were being brought in. They also said, listen to her own words. These prove that she is guilty. These prove that Mr. Suggs is guilty. So the entire closing was used to show the truth of the matter asserted.
For both defendants?
For both defendants.
See, the problem, I guess you'd say, is that, I know it's not an issue here, but severance. Is it possible for the two of them to have been tried together?
That's what we're saying, Your Honor. And in fact, the government stated when they were arguing this that if this wasn't being used for a police investigatory reason, and it was used for the truth of the matter asserted, severance would have been necessary. They stated that, but then they went back and used it for the truth of the matter asserted.
Supposedly confining it to Ogle, but that didn't work, I guess.
It didn't work, confining it to Ogle, and they used it for both Suggs and Ogle.
Do you think that the Ogle statement was the most critical part of the government's case, if it was improperly used, that it was the most important part of the government's case against Suggs?
We do, Your Honor. We believe that that statement, unlike the rest, was independent corroboration of his involvement in the most important part of this case, which was the arrest of Ellenbrecht and then the connection to those drugs.
Ellenbrecht gave a lot of statements about Suggs' involvement also, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But those statements should have been listened to by the jury alone without the support, without being put on the bedrock of this corroboration by this statement. This statement was the only evidence in this case that allowed the jury to recognize that Mr. Suggs received any calls that night about a drug delivery.
See, I'm not disagreeing with you by asking these questions. I just think I'm looking at this as an appellate lawyer figuring out what issues to bring in a case, and if the lawyer thinks that this Bruton issue, although possibly a good one, isn't going to fly because there's other evidence here and a court would find if there was a Bruton problem, number one, and number two, it was harmless to admit that evidence, that wouldn't be ineffective assistance. It's just kind of things lawyers do. They make judgment calls on what issues to raise and which ones to leave on the table. And sometimes you leave, you know, decent ones on the table, but they're not necessarily winners. So I'm wondering here how we should look at this case to say and come out with a conclusion that the lawyer just completely dropped the ball here. This is a dead bang winner issue on Bruton, and had the lawyer raised this, conviction would have been reversed and we've got a new trial without that evidence coming in.
I think, Your Honor, that the fact that this was brought in, that we have to show that there's a reasonable probability that would be a difference in this trial. And we can't talk about this under just sufficiency of the evidence, because evidence of a co-defendant giving evidence that implicates a defendant has been shown to be very prejudicial in and of itself. And then when you show that this it attaches itself to everything that Mr. Ellenbrecht said, and it taints everything that happened, everything that happens about that night of the arrest. And I see that my time is up for rebuttal. I'd like to, the sentencing issue, I'd like to rest on the merits, on the brief. Thank you.
Thanks. Porter?
Why don't you start telling us about how the government used that statement by Ms. Ogle? It does look to me like in the closing argument that there was a Bruton problem in the way it was used.
Judge, there's some confusion over that. The statement by Ogle that he claims is a Bruton problem is her written statement. In closing argument, the government was referring to her oral tape-recorded statements. In closing argument, we say, listen to her words. That's what I was referring to.
Those are the recordings of the conversations with Engel, whatever his name is?
With Ellenbrecht.
Ellenbrecht.
Yes, sir.
I thought there was some closing argument reference to what she told the police, though, and that would reference her custodial statement, right?
There was an argument, and I tried this 6.5 years ago, so I don't remember all of the facts, but I do know that when I talked about her recorded statements, I was referring to, or when I talked about her words, listen to what she said, I was referring to what she had said on the tape recordings that were introduced.
Well, wasn't there some reference to what she told the police in your closing argument?
What she told the police, the only reference to that was that it was totally consistent with all the other witnesses that had testified to it. That's one thing you have to look at. On the introduction of her statements on tape were clearly I introduced as exceptions to the hearsay rule as being co-conspirator statement. Her statement to the police was on a different basis. For instance, one thing to start off with, as Judge Evans pointed out already, there was no motion made to exclude it by the defense at any time. There was no Bruton issue, no severance issue raised below. By the time it came in, it had already been testified to by other witnesses and had been verified by the tape recordings that were already in evidence.
What was verified by other witnesses?
What she had done, John Ellerbrock didn't start off to call Ms. Ogle. He was trying to call Alonzo Suggs.
And she always answered the phone.
And she would answer the phone, and he would say, I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to Alonzo. Now, he had testified to all that, and he had said that she told me, you got to go through me first. All that was already...
You said other witnesses, plural. I mean, other than the testifying co-defendant, the guy who was caught picking up the suitcase, what were the other witnesses that gave evidence that implicated Suggs?
Well, what we're talking about, when I say other witnesses, they're all the police also testified to her actions that evening, what they saw her do, which verified what she told the police in the written statement. They had already testified that she came to this place, that, as Ellerbrock said, the person said, yeah, I would meet you at this place. She came there. I would make you a phone call. She went to the phone and used the phone. That's how they identified her. They went over when she was using the phone to pick her up.
What difference does that make under Bruton?
Well,
just a harmless error argument?
What I'm saying is that if it were error, and I don't believe it was error at all, it was harmless at best, in view of all the other evidence. Also, look at what was said. She didn't directly implicate. This is not your classic Bruton where she said, Mr. Suggs did this, and I didn't have anything to do with it, or I did it, and he did it too, or any one of those kinds of variations. All she simply says was, you're not going to get to Lowe till you come through me. That's all she said. She didn't directly implicate him.
Well, it's an inculpatory, mutually inculpatory statement, and so there is something of a Bruton issue lurking there. Was there any discussion of redacting him from her?
There was no request ever made to at any time.
Were there any cautionary instructions given?
There was a cautionary instruction that any statement of hers would be used solely against her.
Given at the time that her statement?
No, that was not requested. Once again, it was one of the general instructions to the
jury. Final jury instructions.
Right, yes, sir. The jury was instructed to limit its admissibility. And then the other question that Judge Sykes raised is, of course, if it were a problem, if it were determined to be a Bruton problem, the evidence of the appellant's guilt was simply overwhelming in this entire case. I think after obvious deliberation, the appellant counsel just chose an issue that he thought was one that might have some merit to it when he raised it in this court.
What about the weapons enhancement issue here? As I understand the record, there was only one witness who testified to having seen the defendant with a weapon, but there was nothing more specific than that. Is that an accurate statement of the record?
I think in the course of things, it's a little more than that. The witness testified that he saw Mr. Suggs carry weapons on more than one occasion while he was selling drugs. And while that might not be enough for a 924C separate conviction or indictment, it was certainly enough by a preponderance of the evidence standard the court found, having heard the witness, listened to the testimony, and evaluated it, that it was certainly enough for the court to determine that it was more reliable than not, having listened to this witness, having seen the cross-examination of the witness, having heard the objections to the pre-sentence investigation report, and taking all that into account. And also, there was never any rebuttal to it. There was never anything put on by Mr. Suggs to show that the witness was in error in any way.
Well, right, but it's your burden to proof up the enhancement. And if there wasn't anything else other than this generic reference to weapon without more, how is that sufficient under the enhancement?
Well, the guideline simply says that if the court finds that a firearm was possessed.
But was firearm the word that was used, or weapon? It's my recollection from what was recited in the briefs is that the question was, did you ever see the defendant with a weapon? And the answer was yes, twice or three times, something like that. But there wasn't anything more specific than that. That's my question. is there something else in the record to confirm that what everybody was talking about during that exchange was a firearm?
Well, Judge, I don't know that there was, but I think common sense would say that that everyone knew what he was referring to, and if there was any confusion, I mean, everyone, no one raised that. No one said, well, what kind of a weapon are you talking about?
Not,
I mean, are you talking
you
about...
You don't have to raise it. You've got to prove it.
Well, we thought we did, Judge, and because no one...
Do we know what kind of weapon it was?
A firearm of some kind. That's what everybody believed the witness was testifying to.
Was there just one witness on that, whatever his name was? I don't have a name, but... Or were there two? I was hoping maybe you could direct us to the record something in context where it's obvious that's what it was. Somebody looking at a trunk of the car and saw weapons?
No, this was one of the men that dealt or bought drugs from Mr. Suggs and resold them. And he said when Mr. Suggs would come to resell him these drugs, he would have a firearm on him or a weapon on him.
And I wondered if did someone else testify about other weapons in a trunk or something? And I'm not sure. I just was hoping you'd be able to put us to the record that we look at it and say, all right, here's the context of this, where they use weapon. Most people would think when you have a weapon, it's not going to be a baseball bat or pocket knife or something. But that's unfortunately not what he said.
Right, and while I can't...
The judge seemed to recall something more specific.
The judge seemed to recall something more specific. Judge Steele, in my experience with him over the years, is he takes copious notes about things like that.
Yeah, we don't have those.
And right, we don't have those. And like I say, he specifically in sentencing the defendant said that I'm relying on my notes and my recollection of the testimony and how everything came in when I overrule your objection to this. And like I say, without anything more to direct him to say, well, Judge, the word was weapon. What are we talking about here? Was it a baseball bat or was it a firearm or whatever? Everyone simply understood that what we were talking about was the type of weapon that he was convicted in the other count over as well. I mean, it wasn't that the drug dealer carried, you know, some other kind of a baton or that another kind of a weapon with him.
Let's just say that we were to hold that a generic reference to weapon without more is not enough. Is that error prejudicial? It made a difference in the guidelines range, right?
I don't know the answer to that question right offhand because I want to say that it did. The finding of an enhancement for a weapon would have raised the guideline range by the 2 points. Whether that made a difference in the sentence Mr. Suggs received or not, I'm not entirely sure because I think he was, I honestly don't remember the exact sentence and how it was arrived at.
This was a mandatory guideline sentence? I take it since it's so long
ago?
No,
there was a mandatory minimum, but there was a range.
Well, no, but was this pre-Booker is what I'm asking.
I'm sorry?
Was this pre-Booker?
Yes.
Okay.
The sentence on the firearm count, I mean, we could have toss that out here. That's not the controlling sentence
right.
here. It's the
correct.
300 months that he got.
And that's what
that was based in part on a 2-point enhancement for the guideline range was built with that 2-point enhancement in.
That's
so
correct.
If we found that that was not appropriate, it would have to go back for resentencing, wouldn't it?
Not necessarily, and that's what was my answer to Judge Sykes. I don't recall at this point in time how the judge arrived at 300 months. I don't know if that was in the middle of the range, at the high end of a range, or...
It was at the low end of the range.
Oh, okay, or somewhere in between.
That's my recollection anyway.
So what I'm saying is, if you said, well, that was error, we shouldn't have the 2-point enhancement, but the sentence is still within the range even without the enhancement...
No, it wouldn't.
No.
These notes I have is without the enhancement. I think it's 235 to 293.
Okay. Well, like I say, I didn't remember.
If the judge went to the low end of the range, I don't know what his criminal history is, but it's a 65-month difference in his sentence, isn't it? If he went to the low end of the range without the 2-point enhancement,
It could have been. Yes, sir.
That's prejudicial, right?
Well, that would be prejudicial if, like I say, once again, if the judge said, I'm sentencing you to the bare minimum I can under the guidelines, but I've had to apply this thing, but I don't think that's what he did. I'm out of time, obviously. If there's any more questions, I'll be happy to answer them. If not, I would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court under the standards that are relevant in this particular case. Thank you.
Yeah. At 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to mention that the sentencing standard would be at a minimum 8-month difference because of the error in the sentencing, and a maximum of about 5 years. So there is definite prejudice no matter what on that point. I'd also like to say that at the trial, Judge Sykes was correct, that they only talked about, did you ever see him carrying a weapon? Yes. And was that on more than one occasion? Maybe once or twice. Even the context didn't place it within a time period where he was actually dealing drugs or working with drugs at that time. On the Confrontation Clause issue, I want to mention that at trial, the statements made through the telephone calls were not admitted under co-conspirator statements. They stated specifically they were not bringing in them under co-conspirator statements, and they couldn't be brought in under co-conspirator statements. Whether that's true or not, that's not how they were brought in. They were brought in for the same reason, to show the police investigation, and that's supported by the record. And in any case, there is the prejudice existed because the evidence of the written statement tainted everything that happened that night between Ellerbrecht. So the conspiracy, which they tried to prove, which was bringing the drugs from Phoenix to Ellerbrecht to Suggs to the people that sell it, was cut off. And all of that before Suggs is tainted by it. And that the Bruton issue, in Bruton issues, they say that it's so prejudicial that it does affect sentencing. And if there are no more questions, I ask that the sentence be reversed and also the conviction. Thank you.
Thanks. The case will be taken under advisement. And Ms. McGrath, I understand you were appointed in your firm. We appreciate your fine efforts for your client. Thanks very much. That completes the arguments for the day. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.